and a special welcome to you. Last week we started a new sermon series called Eyewitness. And I got to thinking about, you know, that word or that hyphenated word, eyewitness. I bet most of you in this room have witnessed something, an accident, an incident of some sort, where you had to retell that story, whether it was to the police or to somebody trying to put the pieces together. And what you learn in that kind of an experience is that everybody sees some things differently. They see some things that, you know, you didn't see. And the effort then of investigators or police department in that case, this is like a normal accident, is to get as many people, you know, involved as they can to put all those pieces together to see a larger picture. And that's what we're doing in this series. Because when you read through the scriptures, what happens is we get different people's perspectives. The gospel writers themselves, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, have a certain perspective. And so they have many of the same things, but not exactly the same things. And that's, for us, a treasure to receive their insight. And so what we're doing in this series is saying, who are the people that were a part of Jesus' crucifixion in some way or another, from the trial to the burial? And we're looking at folks who've had a part in that. We're going to look at the man who actually took Jesus' body down from the cross, a man by the name of Joseph of Arimathea, coming up. That's coming up in a few weeks. We're going to talk about the centurion soldier who was the soldier ahead, who was head of all the soldiers who had watched a lot of men die. And he's there and makes this confession about seeing Jesus die and what was different about his death than every other man he had watched die across his years of leadership in the Roman army. You'll want to be here to hear that. We last week started with Caiaphas, the high priest. This man of prestige and power who was considered to be, you know, as high priest, the key spiritual leader, but how he became jealous of Jesus and his popularity. And we learned of Caiaphas last week that he was more the instigator of Jesus' trial than any other person. He had more to do with Jesus ending up on the cross than probably anyone else, even more than Pilate. And so today, we stand again to look at another character in the cross. Today, we turn our attention to this man named Barabbas, this one who didn't have prestige and power like Caiaphas did, so he tried to take it. He created a revolt against Rome. He was Jewish by nature, and they were under Jewish oppression. The Jews were under Roman oppression, and so he decided to take it back. As a matter of fact, one of the Gospels, John, calls him a robber. Matthew, Mark, and Luke call him a murderer. But though we don't have a lot outside of the Gospels about him, what we do know is most likely he was an insurrectionist. He wanted to create a movement against Rome and overthrow physically, by military force, overthrow the Roman government. Well, once that fell apart, and he being one of the leaders, if not the leader, he was a dead man walking. You didn't revolt against Rome and live through it. It just didn't happen. You don't get to attack Rome and keep your life, and there would be no question he would be executed for his trial, no doubt, until early Friday morning. And on early Friday morning, something happened. His fate was put in the hands of the crowd. Here's the thing about Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin, these 70 men who were a Jewish ruling body. Now, Rome, if you're familiar kind of with some Roman history, there was the Pax Roma, you know, the peace that they allowed. They allowed you within boundaries to worship freely and do those kind of things. And so the Sanhedrin was a Jewish ruling body. They had no authority in Rome to inflict any kind of judgment by the law. They could only do that by the religious law. And so in Jesus' mock trial, Jesus is convicted of blasphemy, and they desired to put him to death, but they couldn't do that. They had to have Rome's approval. And so this is where they go to Pilate and get Pilate involved in this whole thing. And so in their desire to finally undermine his life, they bring Pilate in on the story and basically say to Pilate, you've got to help us figure this out. And so that's what happens. He's brought to Pilate. As a matter of fact, he's brought to Pilate, and when Pilate looks at Jesus' life, I mean, he's rather objective about this. He's saying to them, I don't see it. I don't see that Jesus has done anything that deserves death. And so he's not convinced, as the Roman governor, that he's going to get involved in this whole thing. And then they begin to remind him that Jesus, who is being seen as an enemy of Rome, Rome doesn't look kindly unless you punish the enemies of Rome. And so they say to Pilate, if you let this man go, this is John 19:12, if you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar. And so now Pilate had a decision to make. If he doesn't do something in terms of punishment for Jesus, Rome's going to come down on him, and he may be the one executed. The only problem is he still, in his own heart of hearts, believes that Jesus is innocent. And so he's indecisive. And finally, he decides to let the crowd decide. This was the time of the Passover feast in Jerusalem. There were more people in Jerusalem during this time where they remembered their freedom from slavery in Egypt, where God took them out of slavery and provided a land for them and made them a people. And they celebrated that annually. And basically, if you were a Jew, no matter how far away you lived, you had to come to Jerusalem at some time during the Feast of the Passover. So Jerusalem was really crowded. I mean, it was more crowded than Scottsville Road on Friday night at 6 o'clock. Okay, it was really, really crowded. Yeah. So it's right in the middle of Passover. And so he decides to ask the crowd. Pilate tries to weasel out of this by saying, basically, who is it that you want me to crucify? Jesus Barabbas or Jesus the Messiah? It's an interesting question. He had the power to do that because it was part of the Passover tradition to allow one Jewish citizen who's committed a crime to go free. And so he puts Barabbas and Jesus before the crowd. And you know how that goes. Now the truth is, we don't know a lot about this other Jesus, Jesus Barabbas. But we do know from the Gospels that he led this revolt. And that's about all we know. I got to thinking this week about that whole experience of Pilate who kind of turns to the crowd of all places. And I got to thinking about crowds. You know, crowds can be pretty fickle, right? There's a whole area of psychology, a whole kind of segment of psychology that talks about mob or crowd psychology. I mean, why would grown men paint their face and their body and stand up at a ball game to put the letters of their school on their chest? Something's wrong with them. We're all impacted by that crowd psychology, aren't we? In one way or another, it happens. Crowds can be tricky. And though Jesus is innocent and Barabbas is not, everybody, you know, that's not directly involved thinks, well, Jesus will be the one to go free. I got to thinking about times when I've been a part of a crowd. You could think about this for your own life. A number of years ago, we were involved at Broadway with two missionaries in Africa. And I was on the first team to go in early 2000, 2001 maybe, something like that. And we had planned for months. We planned basically for a year. And then 6 months, it was intense and, you know, taking shots and getting ready to go and raising money and all that. And we went. There were 10 of us. And just the thought of going to Africa to me was thrilling. And we got to the airport at Nashville. And we couldn't get out of Nashville. We had to fly to Chicago, then from Chicago to London, and then from London to Accra, Africa. And we couldn't get out of all that planning, all that, like, God, we know you're with us. There was a storm in Chicago, and no flights were going out of Nashville to Chicago. Now, this started out friendly with those of us, because this crowd began together. There were a lot of people trying to get to Chicago. And before long, it got ugly. I never felt so sorry for airline people in my life. And you could feel the anger. I mean, literally, you know, here we were, good church people, but there was some in our group, I won't call their names, but one of them's right by, no, I won't call their name. And the anger in them. And finally, we could feel it, and we just said, hey, we're gonna back out of this. And so we moved to the whole back of the what was going on, and people were beginning to yell. I mean, it was getting ugly. It's the first time I've been in a place where I thought, this thing could turn violent. And it was a horrible feeling. And sure enough, we could not get out of the airport, had to spend the night, come back the next day, and we made our trip. But it was my first experience in being in a crowd that could turn violent. And I was reminded of how easily crowds can be swayed. And in this whole field of psychology about this, I kind of boiled it down through my reading to what happens in crowds. There's two main factors. The one is the emotional mood of the crowd becomes contagious. Doesn't matter where you are. Church, ball game, family, where there's a crowd, there's a mood to that crowd. And the second thing I became aware of as I looked at this is we want to fit in. And there's nothing wrong with that, right? I mean, wanting to fit in, wanting to get along with people, that's a good thing. I mean, you wore deodorant this morning because you want to fit in. You know, you want to be nice and smell good and all that. I mean, but we literally honor people and give dignity and respect to people because we want to fit in. And that's a good side of it. But sometimes that desire to fit in becomes extreme. And we will set aside what we most fully believe with all of our hearts, sometimes in a moment, just to fit in, to be a part of that crowd psychology. The biggest thing I got out of reading this crowd psychology stuff is this. There is a people pleaser in all of us. And some part of that is good. But some part of that, if that desire gets out of whack and we begin to think that our worth, our value is based on what someone else thinks of us, it can really get sideways quickly. On Tuesdays, every morning, 10 o'clock, the pastors that are going to teach over the weekend get together. There's usually three of us. There's me, Adam, and then Pastor Cameron Wright, who's actually the pastor at Faith Church. Y'all may not know this, but he works part-time on our staff. And we, what we do in that, we know months ahead of time what the sermons are going to be, and we're all working on that. And on Tuesdays, we get together to say, what's this sermon look like? And here's what I found in my research. And it's really an enjoyable time. I mean, I love that. It's a sacred time. Well, this past Tuesday when we were together, Pastor Laura was with us because Laura is actually preaching this morning. Pastor Adam's in Florida, and we're all jealous of that on the staff. But anyway, Pastor Laura's preaching at the Melrose campus. So it was me, Laura, and Cameron, and Adam. And so we got on stories of when we were in a crowd and we should have done something, and we didn't. And if you were here a few weeks ago, I told my story of that in the Mercy series where I acted unmerciful. Seventh grade, and there was students gathered around another student, terrorizing him. And when I saw what was happening, instead of stepping in, I got out of there. And it stayed with me to this day. And so Adam had a story, and Cam had a story, And then Pastor Laura told her story, and I thought, you know what? I need to tell her story. She remembers vividly being in the fourth grade, Muhlenberg County. And if you don't know where that is, it's just right, Central City, Greenville. You take a vacation sometime and go there. But anyway, it's right up the row. Fourth grade, she's on the playground of her elementary school. She's in the area where the swings are and the seesaw and the slide and the jungle gym, and she's on a swing, swinging. And she said, out beyond that, little play area where the equipment was a big field, wide open, and that's where the kids would often play ball, make up their own games, whatever. And as she was swinging, she noticed someone began to gather, kids began to gather around in a big circle around something or someone. And before long, pretty much everybody out there was making this tight circle, and there was a commotion. She couldn't see it, so she got off the swing and worked her way through the crowd, and she could see that somebody was in the center of the crowd. And finally, she could see who it was. It was Matthew. And she couldn't figure out what was going on until she looked at his feet and noticed he had a shoe missing that he had lost or someone had taken. And now they were throwing the shoe from one person to another. And she said she could see in him he was terrified. And they'd throw the shoe, and Matthew'd run toward them, and then they'd throw the shoe again. And she said, finally, as this was going on, it was zigzagging around the crowd, it finally came to her. And as you know, if you know Laura at all, she's an athlete. She was a true college, high school basketball player, really, really good. And so when the shoe came to her, she caught it. And she said, as soon as she knew that she had a hold of the shoe, Matthew was coming toward her, and she could see the terror, the hurt, tears about to fall. And people were saying, throw it to me, toss it over here, give it to me. And in Laura's words, She said, I reached back and I threw the shoe. And then she wrote this about that. I wish I could tell you that I'd just gotten caught up in the moment and swept away with the crowd, but if I'm honest, there was something much deeper happening. I wanted to please the crowd. I didn't want my peers to think I was a stick in the mud and couldn't have fun. I didn't want them to be mad at me, and I certainly didn't want to be the next Matthew they picked on. I needed their approval for my worth. Well, I bet every one of us in this room, if we think just a little bit, can remember some moment, maybe reaching far back, maybe not so far back, where the shoe was thrown and we caught it, where we had an opportunity and we gave into the crowd. I think as adults we think this is for children in elementary school or maybe teenagers, but I'm telling you, this is real for each and every one of us in this room. When you're in the break room at work and someone's piling on, gossiping about somebody in the workplace, we all have this choice. And it's pretty tempting sometimes to just pile on and be accepted. If you're a social media person, it's pretty easy for people to be knocking someone down, maybe someone you don't even know, and want to be liked and get that thumbs up yourself, and to pile on and throw the shoe. There are times where you're with people that maybe really saying something, maybe as a joke, that's degrading to a gender, to a race, to someone. And it's been easier to just chuckle rather than do the right thing. Or maybe this crowd thing comes out in more subtle ways, much more subtle. Maybe it's simply by seeing an injustice and a wrong, and knowing we could do something and should or need to or somehow need to speak to it and don't. You know, as adults, we tend to think people-pleasing is not our problem. But in the break rooms and boardrooms and back porches and beauty shops, we sometimes feel that pressure and we lean the wrong way. I got to thinking about the crowd that day. I got to thinking about Barabbas. I got to thinking about what he thought was going to happen. Because surely he thought in his mind he was the one that was a dead man walking that day. And so Pilate, trying to escape responsibility, which he could not do, he washes his hands to say, this is not on me. Well, it is on him and everyone there in some way or another. We're told in the Gospel of John that the spiritual leaders of the community had planted people in the crowd to call for Barabbas. So again, the peer pressure would be the first name mentioned would be what people would grab onto. And so when Pilate brings them out and presents them to the crowd, which would have been huge, and he says, I don't see anything wrong in this man, Jesus, who claims to be the Messiah. You know about Barabbas, so which one would you have me crucify? And I think Pilate, I don't know this, but I think Pilate was probably surprised when the crowd said, Barabbas, Barabbas, Barabbas. That's not what they said, is it? Which one would you want set free? Barabbas, Barabbas. Barabbas. Wow. Must have been a shock. And so today, where this leads us in my thinking, as to what about Jesus? How is it that Jesus could avoid being a people pleaser? How is it that Jesus, I mean, to me, all he had to do when he was before Pilate, and Pilate says, are you who you say you are? All he had to do was say, you know, no. He didn't have to give a speech. All he had to do was say no. And Jesus could have walked free. And instead he says basically, you have said so. What was it in Jesus that allowed him? You remember in the Garden of Gethsemane, let me give you a very brief prayer. If you're making any decision in your life, if you're struggling with something that you're looking for direction, let me give you a little prayer to pray during Lent. It was the prayer Jesus prayed in the garden. It is simple. All of us can go out of here with it memorized. And it's simply these words. Not my will, but what? Not my will, but thine. Lord, not my will, but yours be done in my life. That's a prayer you can hang on to. That's a prayer that'll help you have strength when it's easier to just kind of turn the blind eye or maybe to even join in to say, no, I'm not going to do that. I think that's what amazes me about Jesus. You see, Jesus had not come to have people die for him. He could have done that. He could have created that. I mean, he could have at any point when he had large crowds teaching have called them to put up a fight. As a matter of fact, the gospel writers say, I mean, Jesus literally could have called down the forces of heaven and freed himself. Jesus was not a victim. Jesus willingly, courageously chose to lay down his life for you and me. To set us free from the things that all of our self-will can't set us free from. To set us free. I want you to think about who went free because of Jesus' death. It wasn't just Barabbas. The people in the crowd went free in the sense that Jesus could have incited them to fight for him and they would have died. Jesus' death literally sets us free from being, if you will, manipulated by so many other forces in the world. Our own sin, our own brokenness. He had come to set even his enemies free. He died for the crowd that was chanting for someone else's name. He died for the Roman soldiers who would have fought against the crowd if he'd called the crowd into revolt. He died for Pilate, whose life would have been in danger had he walked free. He died for Barabbas, the one who was watching all this happen up close. He died for us that we could be set free. John Ortberg, in one of his books, explains it this way. It is as if he said, I will lay down my life for people who do not understand. That can buy a little time. That can buy a little space so that a community can be formed. And out of sacrificial love, it can change the world. You know what? When we're called to be the church, we are called to be that sacrificial community within our own community, the community of our family. And I'll tell you what, that's not easy. It's easy sometimes to talk about, but when you get into real life and real relationships, we say part of our vision is to be a selfless community of hope. When I hear the words to be a selfless community and I think of my own struggles to be less selfish, wow. But it's a tremendous vision. And I believe it has a chance to impact this world we live in a powerful way. We might not always get it right. I don't always get it right. But I want to invite you to become that kind of community that we come together as a sacrificial people that Jesus died to create. And so for just a few moments, I want to lead you in a prayer. I want to invite the band to come forward at this time. And I want to guide us in a moment of prayer in a specific way. The way I want to do that, I want to, first of all, invite us to I'll show you the posture. We're going to close our eyes in just a moment, but here's the posture. During this, I want you to start with your hands just out in front of you. And I want to just pray for God's love to flow into your life and heart. And then in a few moments during this prayer, I'm going to ask you to turn your hands over and just let go of some things that you may need to let go of. And then I'll have you turn them back with them raised up, pointed up, to receive God's grace and love in your life. Would you bow with me? Just put your hands out in front of you there, your palms up. Father, we come as those who are empty in many ways. Sometimes very full of ourselves. And what we need is for your love to flow into our lives. And so our open hands are your invitation to send your love and let it flow into our hearts, our minds, and our being. We all need to know how much you love us. Sometimes we're our own worst enemy, our own strictest judge. You've not asked us to condemn ourselves. You've not done that. So now we ask for your love to just flow within us. Draw us close to you. Whatever it is we're dealing with, whatever it is that has our attention, our worries, our fears, you're greater. Your love is greater. Your perfect love casts out fear. And now would you turn your palms over as we ask God to search our hearts, as we reflect on what is pleasing to Him, how sometimes fear gets a hold of us, or conflict, or sometimes we want to fit in some way so bad that we violate not only God's ways, but our own beliefs. Would you just release those things to God? Just let go of them. Whatever guilt may be roaming around, whatever struggle, for a moment, just turn it loose to God. Quit trying to grab a hold of it tighter. Fix it. Let it go into the grace and mercy of God. And now would you turn your palms up again? Would you just personally ask God, just quietly, silently in your heart, ask God to send His forgiveness and grace that would empower you to know the right and loving thing as you go through your whole life, today, tomorrow, in the future. Just have your own moment. You ask God for what you need today. Father, we thank you that your promise is if we ask, you are willing to give. Often we just don't ask. But Lord, in this moment we ask, you know, as we hold out our hands, what is heavy for us. You know what guidance or wisdom we need in a situation. What forgiveness we may need. Oh, Lord, thank you that your grace covers the multitude of our missteps and you free us. You don't want us to live in bondage to the crowd or to any other person, but in the freedom of who you've created us to be. May we today be empowered in a special way to be who you've created us uniquely to be in this world. Thank you. Thank you, Jesus, for laying down your life and setting us free. It's in your name we give you thanks. Amen.